I'm always heartened when people want to learn some church history. Together with my friend and colleague that you'll be hearing a bit further down the road, Nick Needham, I have quite strong views on this. This is another story, and I can't afford to get sidetracked, but I would say that in my late teens, the study of Christian history helped to save my sanity as a Christian. I can't overemphasize my personal debt to it. Now, just to explain what you're going to be hearing, I was asked to give two papers on Wilberforce by the pastor of Kingston Reformed Church in Hull, Dennis Hill. They were hoping to take advantage of the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade, and they thought that they would get a lot of people attending these lectures from local history societies and organisations of that sort, simply because of the Hull interest with Wilberforce having been born and raised there. And therefore, I was asked quite specifically to give two distinct lectures, the first of which would focus on his conversion, what Wilberforce called his great change. And I duly prepared that, but I've since given the same material in a number of other settings where there's only been time for one. I would have to say, and those of you who observed me yesterday will understand this, that I'm not good at brevity. And what I'm trying to do is to collapse one lecture into about 10 minutes and then give the whole of the second lecture on Wilberforce. But it's in my nature to get excited, and then I begin to get voluminous. So I hope you'll at least be warned as to what might be following. You'll be aware, of course, that there's a rash of Wilberforce commemorations taking place this year, and you'll be aware, I think, of the new biography by another professional Yorkshireman, William Hague, which looks very promising, I have to say, although as Hague is not himself an evangelical, he tries hard but doesn't really understand the nature of Wilberforce conversion. I think we ought to appreciate that Wilberforce really lived at a tipping point in British society. If, for instance, you measure certain indicators of society as it was in the mid to late 18th century when he was born and was growing up, this was the era of Hogarth's Gin Lane, John Cleland's novel Fanny Hill, which lamentably was recently televised, rough and ready rural sports that were based on cruelty to animals, and then toward the end of Wilberforce's life, you're into the beginnings of the Victorian era, where almost every decade was to see improvements in the social climate of society. And Wilberforce was near the centre of the nation's political life during that change in the moral climate of the day. And it's important that we see that he understood his own role in two ways. On the 28th of October 1787, he wrote this in his diary: "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." Now, that second phrase, the reformation of manners, goes back to Puritan times, and it evokes the sort of concerns the Puritans had. And it's not to do with manners as we use the term, whether you open the door for ladies or whether you say please and thank you, it's more to do with the reformation of civility, of social conduct. So we can see that the suppression of the slave trade was only one of Wilberforce's concerns, and one of his biographers has said that it's probable at one stage in his life that he was involved in about 61 separate initiatives. And while we'll be focusing on the slave trade this morning, almost inevitably we have to, it's worth trying to remember that in the background there was a great deal else going on. Now, Wilberforce was also interesting because he wrote a book. And it was a book that sold well and was translated into several languages. It was called A Practical View of Christianity. That's the short title. In the fashion of the day, the book that he wrote had a considerably longer title. But it was essentially a statement of the principles of evangelical religion. And it was Wilberforce's opportunity to show what prompted him, if not other politicians of the day. Well, Wilberforce was born in Hull in 1759. That was a year of noted military victories against the French. One might almost say, of course, on sea and on land. He could trace his lineage back a long way, right back to the 12th century, to a soldier who fought the Scots under King Henry II. I think probably at the Battle of the Standards, which happened in North Yorkshire. Originally spelt Wilberforce, F-O-S-S. It's a name of some antiquity in the East Riding of Yorkshire, and it's also the name of a small rural parish. There's a place of that name. He was the son of a mercantile family. Hull was a thriving port which earned its money chiefly on the Baltic trade at that time. And Wilberforce lived in a handsome Jacobean mansion as he was growing up, right in the centre of Old Hull in the High Street. It's now a museum to his memory. And he was small as a child and as a grown man. He didn't stand much, I think, above 5'3" in height. And because of that, he developed a prodigious talent, really, for elocution. But in order for this to show, his tutor at Hull Grammar School, a man called Isaac Milner, used to make him stand on his desk so that his voice would carry and that he would be visible to the other pupils. Now, one of the critical events of his early life is that just after his 9th birthday, his father, Robert Wilberforce, died. And this was a very unsettled and unhappy period for him. He'd also lost his older sister, Elizabeth, and there was some fear that his mother might catch the smallpox too. So the decision was taken to send him south to Wimbledon, to the home of his uncle and aunt. His uncle was also William, his aunt was Hannah. And they effectively brought him up for the next few years of his life. Now, the interesting part of the picture here is that his uncle and aunt were convinced evangelicals. They'd known the remarkable and meteoric George Whitfield, that evangelist who blazed like a comet across the British Isles in the middle of the 18th century. And they were on fine and very happy, cordial terms with a certain John Newton, an evangelical clergyman who had, of course, been himself involved in the African slave trade as a young man. And John Newton used to visit the family home, Lauriston House, in Wimbledon, and would take part in what he called parlour preaching. The family would gather the servants together, and young Wilberforce could remember him, for instance, expanding on Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress as a way of getting gospel truth across to the servants in these meetings in the family home. And his letters home, that's the young William Wilberforce, began to develop a kind of evangelical turn of phrase. And this rather alarmed his mother, who conferred with his grandfather, who lived at Ferriby just outside of Hull, and who was known as the Alderman because he'd been mayor of Hull at one point. And grandfather declared, if Billy turns Methodist, he shan't have sixpence of mine. It's worth remembering that the word Methodist at that time did not apply to a Christian denomination, as it does now. It was simply a catch-all term meaning an evangelical. the decision was taken to pluck him out of that environment, fetch him home and scrub his soul clean of enthusiasm. That was another term that was bandied about as a way of putting down evangelicals. He found the transition of life to Hull very difficult to take at first. He'd actually been very happy with his uncle and aunt. Listen to this. My religious impressions continued for some time after my return to Hull, but no pains were spared to stifle them by taking me a great deal into company and to places of amusement. I might almost venture to say that no pious parent ever laboured more to impress a beloved child with sentiments of religion than was done to give me a taste for the world and its diversions. At first all this was very distasteful to me, but by degrees I acquired a relish for it, and so the good seed was gradually smothered, and I became as thoughtless as any among them. In his teens he went to a school in Pocklington, in the East Riding of Yorkshire, and then eventually in 1776 to St John's College in the University of Cambridge. He was recommended there by his headmaster from Pocklington, a man with the splendid name of the Reverend Kingsman Basket. And he was a John's old boy himself. Now, the pattern that was then set was really one of what you might call decorative idleness. You've got to bear in mind that Wilberforce was very wealthy. He would, I think, in modern-day terms, not be among the super-rich, but he would certainly be a comfortable millionaire and somewhat more than that. And it was often suggested to him that he didn't really need to worry about his studies, since he had this private fortune, and therefore he should simply treat Cambridge as a kind of finishing school. And he involved himself in the sporting and social life of a Cambridge college, but not more than that. And in later life, he looked back on those years as being a considerable waste, because he could have fitted his mind for a career in public service, but didn't really do that. One thing, though, that was critical is that in his final year, he made a number of friendships that were to prove very important to him. A circle of young men who were already rising stars in the political firmament, and one of these was William Pitt, the son of Lord Chatham. Lord Chatham, who's known as Pitt the Elder, the former Prime Minister, of course, and William Pitt the younger was soon to become Prime Minister himself. And now Wilberforce knew what he wanted to do with his life. He did not want to go back to Hull and enter the family business. He would become a politician. The great political issue of the day was the war in the American colonies. And Wilberforce, like Pitt, was opposed to it. Really on the grounds that it was bad for trade. Coming, of course, from a sort of mercantile city and a trading family, Wilberforce could see this at first hand, with the mother country locked in an ongoing military dispute with the rebel colonists in North America. There were other elements in the mix as well, it has to be said. Wilberforce, Pitt and others feared that Britain's traditional rivals within the European scene, France and Spain, would take advantage of the war with the colonists, not because they really had any sympathy for their objectives. It's difficult to imagine that French monarchists would support Republican Americans for any other reason than to do the British down. But nevertheless, this was a real fear, and it was proved right in the end, because the American military success came about largely through French help. Well, with all of this in the background, in the year 1780, there was a dissolution of Parliament, and Wilberforce stood for his own native town. Hull was a parliamentary borough at that time. The modern system of constituencies of roughly equal populations didn't exist at that time. Basically, certain boroughs were designated parliamentary boroughs and returned two members of Parliament, And each county also returned two members of Parliament. And Wilberforce stood for Hull. It cost him about £9,000 to win the seat. That was not unusual then. Elections were rough and ready affairs. People did not automatically have the right to vote. You had to qualify by way of a property qualification. The logic behind that was that it was felt that if you simply allowed people to vote simply because they'd been born in a country and lived there, they would vote for all sorts of frivolous reasons. People had to have a stake in the country, as it was said. They had to have something to lose. So property owners, people who owned land or houses, they were entitled to vote once their property reached a certain financial level. Now, the vote of a resident elector in Hull was costing Wilberforce about 2 guineas a throw. And he also, to make sure he got the seat, brought a number of people who were qualified to vote in Hull, but who were resident in London. He brought them up, so he had to pay their travel expenses, had to pay them for the vote, had to provide them with food and drink and so on. And so it cost about £10 a head. And then lavish meals and parties all round. On his last tour of Yorkshire, when he was a very old man, Wilberforce met someone in Halifax who remembered a great ox roast in the garden of the family home as part of his election campaign. And at that point, things were going well, and he appeared with his younger sister, Sally. Someone called out from the crowd, "Mr. Wilberforce and Miss Wilberforce forever." And she had enough presence of mind to shout back, "Not Miss Wilberforce forever, I hope." And it was even suggested that Wilberforce should hire the services of a local butcher, a man named Johnny Bell. And when he asked why, he was told, "Oh, he's a fine fellow if it comes to bruising. You know, if you need to frighten somebody or somebody threw a stone, actually, at Wilberforce at one point that hit him and hurt him quite badly. And Johnny Bell suggested that he'd go around and kill this chap. So Wilberforce replied, "Oh, no, please, just frighten him a little." Well, he won one of the two seats and went to Westminster and became very rapidly one of the rising stars of the day. His natural gift for eloquence, and it has to be said, mimicry, meant that he soon rose to prominence. Quite worrying in certain respects, though, because he had a talent for denunciation that was really not all that pleasant. And one could almost, this is my phrase, but one could almost term him Pitt's Rottweiler. He would savage his political opponents in the House, and he made enemies at this stage in his career. There's no doubt at all about that. Well, that brings us to what he called the Great Change. It occurred across the winter of 1784 and into the summer of 1785. And what was instrumental, really, was his desire to do, as many moderately wealthy British people did at that time, to go on a tour of the continent. He originally had in mind that he was going to take, incidentally, his widowed mother and his sisters, but he wanted a male companion to be company for him. And he thought of taking a Dr. William Burrough from York, but this man couldn't go. So thinking about who he could ask, he thought again of Isaac Milner, his former tutor from the grammar school. Now, Milner was a polymath, a fellow of my old college at Cambridge, and a man with a remarkable academic pedigree. He was 9 years older than Wilberforce, and a great big bear of a man. I've often wondered how it must have looked with the two of them in a carriage. The carriage must have had a permanent tilt in it, with Wilberforce being relatively tiny and Milner being enormous. And at one point, actually, on a journey through the Alps, it was Milner's sheer physical strength that prevented the carriage going off a slippery road. What really mattered, though, was that Milner was an evangelical, and Wilberforce hadn't realised that. Before they set out on their tour of the continent, they met for dinner in a hotel in Scarborough, and conversation turned to an Anglican clergyman called Stillingfleet, who was himself a gospel man, an evangelical, and Wilberforce ventured the opinion, oh, he goes a little too far. And Milner replied, not at all too far, I think. And you can imagine how Wilberforce's spirits sank, thinking, oh dear, what have I got? Am I going to be cooped up in for long journeys with one of those? And it ought to be said, by the way, that Wilberforce at this stage was worshipping at a Unitarian church in London. Now, in the event, Milner turned out to be a charming and engaging travelling companion, and there were serious conversations between the two men about Christianity. But they usually began with Wilberforce, in his parliamentary style, indulging in sort of mockery and raillery of the Christian position. And Milner once said, Wilberforce, I don't pretend to be a match for you in this sort of running fire, but if you really want to discuss these topics in a serious and argumentative manner — now, argumentative didn't mean as it does in the modern sense, it simply meant using serious arguments on both sides of the issue — I shall be most happy to enter them with you. Now, another thing that was a remarkable providence is that in Nice, when they reached the south of France, Wilberforce noticed that one of the female companions in the party, Bessie Smith, had a book on her bedside table. And this turned out to be Philip Doddridge's book, The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And in the 18th century, it was a remarkably effective evangelistic tract, really, a sustained development of the Christian position. But it was almost ideal for Wilberforce because it was written with an educated readership in mind. It wasn't so much aimed at the common man of the day. Wilberforce asked what it was, and Milner seized his moment. Oh, this is one of the best books ever written. We must read it together as we journey. And so that gave them material to talk about. Then, early into the next year, 1785, Wilberforce had to return briefly to attend some parliamentary business, but picked up with the party again in Switzerland. And as they travelled through the Swiss Alps, Wilberforce and Milner, between them, studied the Greek New Testament together. And by the summer of 1785, all of Wilberforce's intellectual doubts about the truth of Christian revelation had been completely dispersed. Really, the issue now is quite simply whether he would launch out and place all his trust in Christ. And two conversations were of critical importance in the late summer, early autumn of that year. First of all, he went to visit John Newton, the only evangelical clergyman he could remember, you know, from his boyhood. But he sought him out. He asked if he could see him in secret. He said, no, my face is well known. I'm a public figure. If I'm seen at your front door, people will assume all sorts of things. And he was so nervous and so uncertain of what he'd meet when he saw John Newton, he walked past his front door three or four times before he had the courage to knock. He was amazed, however, to find that John Newton said that all of the years since his boyhood, Newton had been praying for him. And one of Wilberforce's concerns, you see, is that if he became a decided Christian, he'd have to give up public life. Now, this is a moment, I think, of seminal importance here. Newton said to him that that was not necessary, using the Apostle Paul's words, let every man abide in the state in which he was called, but also the Old Testament examples of Joseph and Daniel, men who served God in the affairs of state in the place where God had placed them. He also had a conversation with William Pitt, his great parliamentary friend, warning Pitt that he might no longer be able to vote quite so frequently according to the dictates of the party line. Now, the party system then was much more rudimentary than it is today, and the party whip was not enforced nearly as rigorously, but Wilberforce wanted to let his friend know that there were now higher claims on his allegiance than adherence to party. Now, it's amazing that for the sake of their friendship, Pitt, who was not an evangelical and never became one, was willing to give him a hearing, even was on his way to his own estates in Kent and diverted to Wimbledon to talk to Wilberforce. That would be nothing today. But when you have to ride a horse to do it, as they did in the late 18th century, that was half a day's journey. And set Wilberforce mind at rest over this. Well, that's my attempt to condense the first paper. We've now got Wilberforce a Christian. Let's move on. I want to talk now about the abolition of the slave trade. Remember that diary entry? God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. Well, once he had decided that he could no longer be a machine politician, Wilberforce needed a cause. And in fact, it was Pitt and others who suggested the abolition of the slave trade to him. It didn't originate with him. A number of Quaker figures had already been involved for some decades in pressing for the abolition of the slave trade. But the cause did need a good front man in Parliament. And in particular, there's a conversation that took place with Pitt in the grounds of his estate at Brobley, under the shadow of a great tree, which is still called the Emancipation Oak. And this settled it in his mind, and just before Christmas, 1787, Wilberforce declared that he would introduce a bill in the new session of Parliament after Christmas to effect the abolition of the slave trade. Note the date, 1887. The bill actually achieved its royal assent in 1807, so it was a 20-year marathon to get this legislation through. Now, the first hurdle was that actually very early in the new year, Wilberforce became seriously ill, and he went to Bath, having been advised that the medicinal waters might be good for a cure. The doctors prescribed opium. Now, this proved to be a somewhat fateful step. He became dependent on it for the rest of his life. If you had watched the recent movie, I think that overplays the issue of his opium dependency. He was able to self-medicate, and for most of his life he was down to 3 doses a day. But you need to remember that medical opium, laudanum as it was called, was one of the few painkillers available to medicine at that time. Now, it seems actually that Wilberforce was suffering from ulcerative colitis, and at one point he was advised that he should put his affairs in order. He wasn't going to live. And he even asked Pitt to take up the cause of abolition if he didn't survive to see it through. Well, in the end, he recovered enough to be able to address the House of Commons in May 1789. Note these words about the slave trade. I confess to you, so enormous, so dreadful, so irremediable did its wickedness appear, that my own mind was completely made up for abolition. Let the consequences be what they would, I from this time determined that I would never rest until I had effected its abolition. Now, his case was always well briefed and well documented, and he was able to explain the kind of figures involved. We're referring here to what was known at the time as the triangular trade. It operated mainly out of West Coast ports in Britain. The two most notable ones were Liverpool and Bristol, but also a sleepy little town called Lancaster that was involved then in the African slave trade, and some of the fine old wharves along the quayside that are now gentrified, where people who have top jobs in the city council can afford to turn them interiors into bijou little flats. They were warehouses involved in the African slave trade originally. What largely happened is that what were known as trade goods, things like axes, cooking pots, firearms, were exported from Britain to West Africa in ships. And the local African chieftains who had enslaved their neighbours very often, or in many cases, in fact, it was Muslim Arabs from the Saharan region who were enslaving black people immediately south of them, they would receive these goods in return for the human cargo. The black Africans were then taken across the Atlantic. This was known as the Middle Passage in the Triangle. The Middle Passage was truly dreadful. They were packed in such enormous numbers and unsanitary conditions. Later on, officers in the Royal Navy said that you could usually smell a slave ship before you saw it, up to 5 miles away. They were taken to the West Indies, which were, of course, British colonies at the time, to the British colonies in North America that became the first 13 states of the United States of America, too. And that accounts largely, not entirely, for the current sort of Afro-American populations there. Now, after that, the ships would be loaded up either with cotton from the American mainland or with sugar from the West Indies and brought back to Britain. Wilberforce faced a number of obstacles along the way. Powerful vested interests supported the slave trade. In part, there was the simple appeal to patriotism. Few figures in British public life captured the nation's imagination quite as much as a certain Admiral Lord Nelson. And he had this to say on the subject. "I was bred in the good old school and taught to appreciate the value of our West Indian possessions, and neither in the field," he means the field of battle, "nor the Senate," meaning government, "shall their just rights be infringed while I have an arm to fight in their defence or a tongue to launch my voice against the damnable doctrine of Wilberforce and his hypocritical allies." Now, people would take note of anything Nelson had to say on any subject whatever because of his almost stellar career as arguably the greatest admiral the world has ever seen. It was also sometimes argued as well that for a nation like the United Kingdom, which was heavily dependent on overseas trade, to abolish the slave trade, well, that would be tantamount to economic suicide. You see, in the same way that it's sometimes argued nowadays, if I might use an analogy, that if the United Kingdom were to surrender its nuclear deterrent, there would be no likelihood at all that other nations which possess those weapons would also abandon them. So we'd be conceding an advantage to potential enemies if we were. Now, that's the argument. I don't know, of course, how individuals among you bounce on the issue in question, but thinking back now to the slave trade, it was often suggested that if we acted unilaterally in abandoning the use of cheap slave labour, we would concede an economic advantage to our competitors, France, Portugal, Spain, and other nations too, who would continue to use slave labour in their colonial systems. Why lose an economic asset? Why deliberately abandon it? Now, there were also rumblings, it has to be said, from within the West Indies. Some of the island assemblies that were run really by small planter aristocracies declared that if Britain forbade the use of African slavery on their plantations, they would simply federate instead with the infant United States. You know, there was essentially say, we're off. We're not going to be British colonies anymore. We'll join the Americans. They understand how to do things properly. They still have slaves. Now, there were times as well when Wilberforce was faced with threats of physical violence. In 1790, a slave ship captain named Robert Norris had threatened to murder him. Now, in the end, it turned out to be an empty threat, but 2 years later, there were two other incidents. Firstly, another slaver named Rolleston challenged Wilberforce to a duel. Wilberforce refused. Actually, Wilberforce had written about dueling in his book, A Practical View, He thought it was one of the great evils of the day. How could a person put his life at risk and therefore perhaps rush into the presence of Almighty God in the very act of offending him? And Wilberforce even strongly disapproved of the fact that William Pitt had once fought in a duel. But you can see how in the climate of the day it was easy then to accuse Wilberforce of cowardice. And on another occasion, a man named John Kimber, captain of a slave vessel, was acquitted on a charge of murder because a slave girl on one of his ships had died under severe maltreatment. Wilberforce made his disgust at this acquittal plain in the House of Commons. So Kimber retorted with a demand for compensation for his hurt feelings at having been lampooned in the House of Commons. A public apology, he wanted. A sum of £3,500. You imagine the purchasing power that would command then, as opposed to today. And, as he put it, such a place under the government as would make me comfortable. Now, what he meant was he was asking for a job, a sinecure. A position where he wouldn't have to do much, but would have an income for the rest of his life. Wilberforce refused, so Kimber basically took to stalking him for the next 2 years or so. And Wilberforce needed to use his friend Lord Rokeby, who went around with him as an armed bodyguard. There were times when Wilberforce faced quite cynical delaying tactics. The occasion in 1792, for instance, when a leading Scots politician, Henry Dundas, effectively scuppered his bill just by inserting the word gradual into it. You know, asking the House of Commons to say, yes, we believe in the abolition of slavery, the gradual abolition of slavery. Effectively ruined the bill that year. One of the most painful reverses of them all came in March 1796, when yet another bill, is effectively introducing them parliamentary session by session, was lost just because of the apathy of his supporters. The House divided, 74 against the bill, 70 for it, and Wilberforce found out that half a dozen of his friends had gone to the theatre that night. And if they'd only turned up and supported the division, it would have been carried. And it's clear that in addition to all this, one powerful element that was often argued against the case for abolition was simply this. The United Kingdom was at war for most of this period, at war with France. The war that is now usually termed the Napoleonic War. It was only that after the first half dozen years or so, but nevertheless, war was going on almost continuously from 1792 to 1815. And at least until Nelson gained a decisive naval victory over the combined fleets of France and Spain at Cape Trafalgar in 1805, there was always lurking in the background the fear that an invasion of the United Kingdom might be feasible. People with a good telescope could go to Dover and look and see the barges that were being collected in the harbours at Boulogne to carry French troops across the Channel. And as Napoleon used to argue, if only he could get control of the Channel for just one day. The British army was tiny, it would not be able to stand against his veterans if he could only get them landed. But the naval victory at Trafalgar reduced all that possibility, and Admiral Sir John Jervis, First Lord of the Admiralty, once reassured his colleagues by saying, "My lords, I do not say they cannot come, I only say they cannot come by sea." Well, what you have to bear in mind is, if you've talked at all with the generation that remembered 1940, when German troops were only 22 miles away across a thin stretch of water, and for a year and a bit more it seemed as a real possibility that an invasion was imminent. Now, that was there in the background, you see, and you could imagine people saying to Wilberforce, However just your case might be, are we not preoccupied with something even more important at the moment? Mere national survival? And again, this is in the background. The climax finally came on the night of the 23rd of February, 1807. Wilberforce's old ally Pitt had died the previous year, and Lord Grenville was now Prime Minister, assisted, interestingly, by Charles James Fox. And Fox had at one stage counted himself an enemy of Wilberforce, because prior to his conversion, Wilberforce's invective had thoroughly annoyed and alienated him. But now Fox was willing to give cautious support to Wilberforce's measure. During the course of a debate, which lasted almost the whole night, the best speech was given by Sir Samuel Romilly, and he made what seemed at first sight a strange comparison. He asked the House to compare the homecomings of two different men. On the one hand, Napoleon Bonaparte, still secure and commanding most of continental Europe under his control in Paris. And Romilly developed this picture, and interestingly, Napoleon was also a small man in stature. Strange coincidence that is perhaps worth pointing up. Well, Romilly asked the House to think about the way that this man often came home to cheering crowds, but it was all because of the amount of blood that he'd shed. At the end of the day, he was a tyrant. And then think of Wilberforce going home to his family and his domestics. Nothing more than that. Just an ordinary, prosperous Englishman and public servant returning to his family. But he could lie down in peace because he preserved the lives of so many millions of his fellow human beings. If you let this bill pass, that was Romilly's argument there. Now, it was one of those moments when the House of Commons was at its best. When the division came, almost the entire House stood as one man, and facing Wilberforce, cheered wildly, hats in the air. The little member for Yorkshire, as he now was, he'd been elected for one of the county seats somewhat after his election for Hull. Well, he sat on his bench, head in hands, and sobbed and sobbed. 20 years it had taken. When the House divided, it was ayes 283, noes 16. A resounding victory. And in the early hours of the morning, when he'd gone to his home at Clapham, spoke to his cousin, Henry Thornton, and just rather puckishly posed the question, "Well, Henry, what shall we abolish next?" And his cousin replied, "The lottery, I think." That brings me then to a group who are known as the Clapham Sect, or sometimes in their own lifetime, actually, that was a name that was really applied later, the Saints. In the spring of 1792, this man Henry Thornton, Wilberforce's cousin, had purchased a house called Battersea Rise. It was a handsome estate on the southwest side of Clapham Common. Clapham at that time was not in London. It was a pleasant rural location about 5 miles outside of the city boundary. It's hard to think of it that way now. That's the Clapham Junction is the biggest, at least the most active railway station in Europe, isn't it? Thornton's father, John, was a wealthy merchant who'd grown rich by astute trading in the Baltic. A devout Anglican evangelical. He'd contributed £200 a year to support John Newton's ministry, for instance. And he gave generously to evangelical causes of all kinds and helped to found Dartmouth College in America. Now, Henry Thornton, the younger Thornton, became a considerable figure in his own right. It's interesting to note that he has a deserved place in British history as one of the earliest proponents of monetary theory. and the development of the British banking system. The pressure of the war with France, you see, had meant that the gold currency, golden guineas, as they then were, had been withdrawn from circulation and replaced by a paper currency. Now, if ever you look at a Bank of England note, you'll see a relic of those days in the phrase, "I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £5. In other words, this is not £5. It's a promissory note. Take it to the bank and you'll get £5 for it. That was the original thinking. And in the year 1802, Henry Thornton wrote a pamphlet called The Enquiry into the Nature and Effects of the Paper Credit of Great Britain. And it set out to reassure the public that the use of a paper currency was not of itself necessarily an indication that the nation was on its uppers. It was thought of initially, you see, as a temporary wartime measure. Now, in 1792, when he purchased this house in Clapham, he was still a bachelor, and partly with a view to sharing the expenses of his new home, and partly with a view to enjoying the fellowship of a good friend, he proposed to Wilberforce that the two of them should set up what he called a chummery. So they moved in together. And that was really the beginning of what became known as the Clapham sect. It's almost the sort of way that students nowadays, in order to help with their fees, you know, might, after their first year living in halls and realising how expensive it is, will rent a house together. And now, they discovered by happy accident that they had complementary personalities. They meshed extremely well and somehow together became much more than they would have been apart. Thornton was a born organiser, chairman and planner. Wilberforce, on the other hand, was a man of such sparkling personality and general amiability that he was able to smooth the wheels. So personable that he had a lovely ability to make Christianity attractive. People liked him, and through that they found that their arguments against Christianity sometimes crumbled. It obviously made a very attractive man in Wilberforce. The Prince Regent, the future King George IV, you understand the name for the title Prince Regent? His father, George III, had periodic bouts of illness and was not able to reign at those times. He was the victim, actually, of a condition called porphyria, and it affected the balance of his mind. It's probably dietary factors that explained this. You know, there are chemicals in his system that unfortunately affected his brain chemistry sometimes. Very unhappy business. It's said that once in Hyde Park he shook hands with the tree, thinking it was the Prussian ambassador. Well, this means that his son, the future George IV, became what was called the Prince Regent, acting in his father's place. Now, he was notorious for his dissolute lifestyle, but he once said that he'd go anywhere to hear Wilberforce sing. You know, his social skills were very finely honed. The Clapham Circle grew as Thornton built two houses on either side of Battersea Rise for two of his friends, also evangelical Anglicans, committed to the cause of abolition. One was named Edward Elliot, the other was Charles Grant. Grant had recently come back to England from India. He had this to say of Wilberforce: "I'm in hopes that some good may come of our Clapham system. Wilberforce is a candle that should not be hid under a bushel. The influence of his conversation is, I think, great and striking. I'm surprised to find how much religion everybody seems to have when they get into our house. They all seem to submit and to acknowledge the advantage of a religious life, and we're not at all thought guilty of carrying things too far." Now, Grant's presence in the group gave an Indian dimension to their interests and led to another 20-year-long struggle. Some of you will be aware that the Baptist missionary William Carey had left for India in 1792, but was not permitted to pursue his calling in any British-controlled part of India. the East India Company, a great merchant company that effectively ran substantial parts of the subcontinent then, was opposed to the presence of missionaries. And Carey could only stay in India because there was a tiny little Danish enclave based around the city of Serampore. And Carey had to live there for a good while. Now, Wilberforce, Thornton and others mounted a long campaign to get government approval for missionary activity in India, as well as the abolition of such practices as the burning of widows on their husbands' funeral pyres. And Christian missionaries were finally granted permission to operate in East India Company-controlled territory in 1813. In March 1793, this little group of friends acquired its chaplain when a clergyman named John Venn was appointed to the living of Holy Trinity Church on the north side of the common. He was a shy man, but a very gifted preacher, and his sermons attracted large congregations that often filled the building. Then the lawyer, James Stephen, joined the group in 1794. What was crucial in his case is that he'd lived in the Caribbean on the island of St. Kitts and had been able to see the effects of slavery at first hand. He was to marry Wilberforce's sister Sarah, so she wasn't Miss Wilberforce forever, and used his legal skills to draft the successful bills of 1807 and eventually of 1833. The Clapham Circle also produced a magazine. It was called the Christian Observer, and it was edited by a man called Zachary Macaulay. He'd spent most of the 1790s as the governor of Sierra Leone. Now, that little colony in West Africa was intended by the British authorities to have the same function as Liberia in American thinking. It was to be a home for freed slaves, to give them the opportunity to return to Africa. The phrase Clapham sect was itself originally intended as a derisory term, and it was coined several decades after the existence of this group. They were mockingly known in their own day as the Saints, and of course Wilberforce eventually left Clapham when he married and moved to an area known as Kensington Gore. It's more or less where the Albert Hall now stands, to be closer to Parliament, but he always looked back on this time with great affection. It's been described as a meeting that never adjourned. And as we've seen, it began in an outwardly quite haphazard way when two young bachelors came together to share a home. But it lasted for almost two decades as a tightly knit group of Anglican evangelicals. They were almost all of them Anglicans. There's one Unitarian who was involved. Mostly, but not all of them, in Parliament, and they'd made common cause to serve God and their generation. And their achievements were many, far beyond slavery. The founding, for instance, of the British and Foreign Bible Society, the Church Missionary Society, and more practical ventures like the founding of the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. One figure who functioned as a kind of honorary member was a lady named Hannah Moore, who was described in her own lifetime as a bishop in petticoats. She persuaded Wilberforce and Thornton to help set up schools for village children in one of the most deprived rural areas of the country at that time, the Mendip Hills in Somerset. Much, it has to be said, against the opposition of the local parochial clergy. It also enjoyed the vigorous support at a distance from Charles Simeon in Cambridge, that remarkable Anglican clergyman. And although he was by no means an Anglican, when the group went on holiday and went to Bath to take the waters, their unofficial chaplain there was the independent minister, William Jay. If you like Banner of Truth books, you can get a collection of Jay's letters, still in print. Well, let me speak for a short while about Wilberforce's family life. 5 years after he died, in 1838, a 5-volume Life of William Wilberforce appeared, and it became a staple of middle-class Victorian Sunday reading. There was a tradition in Victorian society that on Sundays you had to read something improving. You wouldn't read things that you might read on Monday to Saturday. And this work made much of Wilberforce's devotion to his wife and children and to the pattern of family prayers in their household. And in fact, a volume of his family prayers had already been published only a year after his death in 1834. Now, in view of all this, in view of the fact that his home life became regarded as something of a model, it's interesting to note that he didn't actually marry until he was 37. His bride was a young lady called Barbara Spooner. She was just 20. They're married after a whirlwind courtship that lasted just 6 weeks. Seems that he proposed by letter, and that she accepted him by letter as well. And he confided in his diary, "I believe she's admirably suited to me, a real Christian, affectionate, sensible, rational in habits, moderate in desires and habits, capable of bearing prosperity without intoxication and adversity without repining." I ought to point out that the word sensible didn't quite carry the same meaning in the early 19th century that it does today. It meant rather than someone who thought a lot. But nowadays it tends to simply have the opposite meaning to silly. But even the word silly had a different meaning then to what it has today. They were to share 36 years together in the end, and he was to save her a more tender, excellent wife no one ever received as a gift from the Lord. 6 children were born to them within a period of 10 years, and while it was a pious home that a later generation of Victorians regarded as a role model, it was certainly not the stereotype of the 19th century home where children were kept away from their parents by an army of domestics who would look after them, governesses, nannies and so on. It's quite obvious that Wilberforce loved the company of his children and often played with them. He once seriously injured his leg while playing cricket with his oldest son, William. Actually, he was probably too old by that stage to be doing that sort of thing, but I think he just couldn't stop himself. And one of his letters contains a line that he was going to have to stop writing, and he would return to the letter later when he could, because, as he put it, he'd been irresistibly summoned to a contest at marbles. Now, in honour of the coronation of King George IV, when the Prince Regent finally became king, he provided ale and cricket for his servants and for all the family. Now, growing up as I did in sort of fundamentalist circles, that made me feel a little wry, because social trends within evangelicalism would have meant that 40 years later it would have been impossible to put on an entertainment involving a cricket match and providing free beer. At Kensington Gore there was a Twelfth Night party in 1815 where Wilberforce and his guests all played blind man's buff for 2 hours, and his children's diaries include references to such things as being taken to see jugglers, going to the British Museum, their father arranging for his friend, a leading Quaker scientist of the day, William Allen, who was a member of the Royal Society. The irony is that he still wouldn't be allowed to stand for Parliament or vote, not being an Anglican at that stage in British history. But he came to the home to carry out chemical experiments in front of the children to amuse them. He often played chess with them, and he would read to them at night from the Arabian Nights or from Shakespeare. And as they grew up and moved away, he corresponded with them. There are over 600 letters of his that are extant to his third son, Samuel. Samuel became Bishop of Oxford, and took part in a famous debate with Thomas Henry Huxley over Darwin's theories. Conventional wisdom, by the way, is that Samuel Wilberforce, who was nicknamed Soapy Sam, got the worst of that debate. But I'm not entirely sure that he did. I think that needs revisiting. Now, visitors also used to say that they found Wilberforce an engaging host. There was almost nothing that he wasn't interested in. He could converse intelligently on a vast range of subjects. And one of his friends, James McIntosh, had this to say of him. If I were called upon to describe Wilberforce in one word, I should say that he was the most amusable man I ever met in my life. Instead of having to think of what subjects will interest him, it's perfectly impossible to hit one that does not. I never saw anyone who touched life at so many points. And this is the more remarkable in a man who's supposed to live absorbed in the contemplation of a future state. When he was in the House of Commons, he seemed to have the freshest mind of any man there. There was all the charm of youth about him. Do you see the point that McIntosh is making here? He's saying that the picture that people have of Wilberforce is that he's too heavenly minded to be any earthly good. That charge that's sometimes levelled at Christians. But in point of fact, he was as lively as a cricket in a lot of his social contacts. And he reminds me in that respect of something that was once said of George Whitefield by a lady from New York, who said, Mr. Whitefield was so pleasant it almost tempted me to become a Christian. Well, it's time, I think, to sum up and bring Wilberforce to the end of his course. Are you all right for just a little longer? Are you coping? The last two decades of his life were marked by increasing ill health. His eyesight was poor, and he became dependent on the services of a reader. Even for his devotions, his Bible reading, he employed a man who would read his correspondence and his books aloud to him. He'd always been a small man, but as the years passed, this was accentuated because he suffered from curvature of the spine. Very few people outside his immediate family knew that he wore a padded steel brace under his clothing to correct this, but he accidentally left one behind once at the home of Lord Calthorpe, and when he wrote requesting that it be sent on to him, he said this: How gracious is God in giving us such mitigations and helps for our infirmities. Now, the medical profession of the day, as we've seen, did not appreciate the dangers of morphine dependency, and the fact that he was taking opium three times a day can't always have helped his sharpness and of his mental faculties. His continuing involvement in the fight to see slavery abolished also saw some cruel disappointments. The early 19th century was not without the equivalent that you get today of the kind of charity begins at home lobby. And there were those who were willing to assert that Wilberforce had done nothing at all for the labouring poor of England, who were becoming the victims of the emerging factory system. Or, of course, in this part of the world, the coal mines. And those who are suffering in the dark satanic mills, as William Blake coined the phrase. One of the nastiest such attacks came from one of the few political radicals in the House of Commons, a man named William Cobbett, a maverick, in many ways one of the great characters of the age, but it's unfortunate that he should have turned his cannons on Wilberforce in the way he did. Listen to this. You seem to have a great affection for the fat and lazy and laughing and singing and dancing Negroes. But never have you done one single act in favour of the labourers of this country. You make your appeal in Piccadilly amongst those who are wallowing in luxuries, proceeding from the labour of the people. You should have gone to the gravel pits and made your appeal to the wretched creatures with bits of sacks around their shoulders and with hay bands around their legs. You should have gone to the roadside and made your appeal to the emaciated, half-dead things who were there cracking stones to make the roads as level as a die for the tax-eaters to ride on. What an insult it is, and what an unfeeling, what a cold-blooded hypocrite must he be that can send it forth. What an insult to call upon people under the name of free British labourers to appeal to them in behalf of black slaves, when these free British labourers, these poor, mocked, degraded wretches, would be happy to lick the dishes and bowls out of which the black slaves have breakfasted, dined or supped. What do you make of that? Now, Cobbett, I'm sure, knew, actually, that it was grossly unfair. It was public knowledge that Wilberforce had been involved in many initiatives to help the disadvantaged in Britain as well as abroad. But what could not be known was the extent of his private charities. For some time before he'd married, he'd resolved to try and live on a quarter of his income so that he could help those in need. And there are numerous cases of individuals who benefited from a leg up, as it were, at a critical moment in their lives. But there was also sadness within the family. His older daughter, Barbara, died of consumption at 32, shortly after Christmas in 1821, and his oldest son, William, the one with whom he played cricket, he proved to be a constant worry. Wilberforce prayed for him, but there never seemed to be anything showing of the great change that Wilberforce had went through himself. One diary entry reads like this: "Oh, my poor William, how strange he can make so miserable those who love him best, and whom he really loves. His soft nature makes the sport of his companions, and the wicked and idle naturally attach themselves to him like dust and cleave like burrs. I go to pray for him. Alas, could I love my Saviour more and serve him, God would hear my prayer and turn his heart." You see what Wilberforce is really saying in this diary entry? It's all my fault that my boy isn't a Christian. If I were more prayerful and more devout and more in tune with the God that I love and serve, who knows, he might have heard my prayers for my son. Now, when news came home that William was missing lectures and squandering his allowance at Cambridge, Wilberforce tried to discipline him by cutting his allowance. But in the end, there was a tragic outcome to all this. In 1825, Wilberforce had retired from Parliament. He was already quite an old man and his health wasn't good. He'd bought a home called Highwood Hill, near Mill Hill in Hendon Parish, fully expecting to live out the rest of his days there. But just 6 years later, he was left with no option but to sell it. The reason being that William had incurred debts of £50,000. And that's a sum worth several million at current values. This was in a failed business venture. Simply, he had no head for handling money at all. But Wilberforce Senior felt compelled to honour his son's debts and to bail him out. Well, friends rallied round and offered to meet all Wilberforce's expenses, but he wouldn't have it. Felt that it was his duty to stand by his son at this critical time. And he only allowed his friends to help in just one matter. He had endowed a new living at a church in Mill Hill so that he could see that an evangelical clergyman was appointed to that living. And he hoped at least that his friends would rally and help to keep that cause going. So he had to sell up his home, basically, and for the rest of his life, he and Barbara went round their sons, their two other sons. Both were clergymen. Samuel was rector of Brightstone on the Isle of Wight at this stage, and Robert was rector of East Farley in the Medway Valley in Kent. He eventually converted to Catholicism. Now, it's extremely sad to think that a man who'd spent several fortunes helping others was reduced almost to beggary by the fecklessness of his own son. For some time now, he'd ceased to be the effective leader of the campaign for the abolition of slavery. He'd handed over the reins to a young Quaker named Thomas Fowell Buxton. And his last appearance at a meeting of the Anti-Slavery Society in London was on the 15th of May, 1830. 2,000 people crowded into the Freemasons Hall when, to great acclaim, Thomas Clarkson invited him to take the chair. It was almost his last public act on behalf of the cause. Apart from a brief cameo appearance in Maidstone, that's in Kent, of course, he was obviously staying with his son there, and this is January 1833. I say, and say honestly and fearlessly, that the same being who commands us to love mercy also says, do justly. And looking around the room, the old man, as he now was, very frail and very stooped, and his voice feeble now, if as eloquent as ever, he could still coin a well-turned phrase, went on. I trust that we approach the very end of our career. And at that point, a ray of light shone through the building. Windows were placed in such a way that the sun shone right through the hall. And Wilberforce's sense of timing hadn't deserted him. He seized the moment. The object is bright before us. The light of heaven beams on it and is an earnest of success. In May of that same year, 1833, he went to Bath, suffering from influenza, hoping that the waters might effect a cure. But there was no help, and after 2 months it was clear that he was in decline. And in July he went back to London, it can't have been an easy journey, to consult an eminent physician, one Dr. Chambers, who'd helped him in the past. He was to stay at 44 Cadogan Place, a house lent by his cousin Lucy Smith. One morning he was to receive a visit from a young Member of Parliament, a certain William Ewart Gladstone, of whom his biographer Philip Magnus once said that, almost unique among British politicians, his inner life coincided almost entirely with his outer life. The man that he was on the outside and in public seems to have been at one with the person that he really was. Gladstone wrote this of him: he is cheerful and serene, a beautiful picture of old age in sight of immortality. Heard him pray with his family. Blessing and honour are upon his head. During the night of Friday the 26th, the bill for the abolition of slavery, not slavery as such rather than the trade in slaves, which had been abolished in 1807, it passed its second reading in the Commons, which made its eventual success virtually guaranteed. It included the provision that £20 million would be paid to purchase the freedom of slaves throughout all British dominions. In other words, that slave owners would receive some compensation. It has been ironically pointed out that the slaves themselves were never compensated for what they suffered, except by being set free. Nevertheless, this was the first civilized nation in the Western world to abolish slavery in that way. The news was brought to Wilberforce, the last news that he ever received from Parliament. It was almost 50 years now since he'd first introduced a bill to abolish the slave trade in the dying days of 1787. And his response: thank God that I should have lived to witness a day in which England is willing to give 20 million sterling for the abolition of slavery. 2 days later, on the 28th of July, it was clear that he was sinking. To his son Henry, he said, I am in a very distressed state. Yes, Henry replied, but you have your feet on the rock. And self-effacing to the last, the old man said, I hope I have. At 3 a.m. on the following day, and bear this in mind, the man who could have been Prime Minister when Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo, and imagine the reputation he would have gained had that been the case, he breathed his last. Well, as the scripture says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Soon after, only hours after, the family received a letter from the Lord Chancellor, Henry Brougham, bearing the signatures of many members of both Houses of Parliament. We, the undersigned, members of both Houses of Parliament, being anxious upon public grounds to show our respect for the memory of the late William Wilberforce, and being also satisfied that public honours can never be more fitly bestowed than upon such benefactors of mankind, earnestly request that he may be buried in Westminster Abbey, and that we may have permission to attend his funeral. So, the little man from Hull was buried among the kings. In the funeral procession, the Duke of Wellington was observed, along with other notables, himself somewhat getting on in years, but still recognisable with his tall bearing and his prominent beak of a nose. The hero of Waterloo, he always got a cheer wherever he went. And people saw him and were about to remove their hats and call out. And the Iron Duke simply put his finger to his lips. On his memorial statue in Westminster Abbey can be found this tribute from Lord Macaulay. In an age fertile in great and good men, he was among the foremost of those who fixed the character of their times, because to high and various talents he added the abiding eloquence of a Christian life. Or if you want a more pithy epitaph, William Jay, the independent minister of Bath, said this of him, that he was good among the great and great among the good. Well, you've been most patient. Thank you.